What's up, my friends? Kyle Tierman here, and I have a book recommendation for all of you. I love reading. I think it makes people more interesting. I think it makes the world a better place. And I didn't start reading until I was in my mid-20s. I gotta be honest with you. I was late in life. My parents tried so hard to get me to read. Was not interested one bit. Loved movies, skateboarding, and nothing else. Surfing, too. Surfing came a little later. Skating was like 6 to 15, and then surfing was like 12 to now. I've been having really fun surfing, by the way. God, I got some good boards. Took a trip, recorded a podcast. That one's coming soon. Well, on the trip, and I'm feeling juiced, feeling amped on life. Whenever you're feeling a little down, a little low, getting in the ocean, going surfing, what a damn good way to get back above water. Pun intended. But before we get this podcast going, I want to give you a book recommendation. This one is Tuesdays with Maury. I just finished it. Chris Ryan recommended it to me, and it's one of my new favorite books. Here's a line from the book. A couple lines. The last class of my old professor's life took place once a week in his home, by a window in his study where he could watch a small hibiscus plant shed its pink flowers. The class met on Tuesdays. No books were required. The subject was the meaning of life. It was taught from experience. The teaching goes on. Very well-written book about the meaning of life, and it's by a sports journalist who's interviewing his dying professor. And it's just powerful. Tuesdays with Maury, that's my recommendation for you. This podcast is supported by people like you, and it's brought to you by my Substack newsletter. So if you want to hear from me just once a week on Friday, I have a newsletter where each week I pick a new word that I'm learning, toying with, think is funny, and write a little something about it. It's not much, just a couple paragraphs, hopefully something to make you smile, and it'll hopefully grow your own vocabulary. So if that's something that is interesting to you, you can go to tierman.substack.com or click the link below and sign up for my newsletter. That's also where I post all these podcasts. So if you have things to say about these podcasts, comments, you can do that in the Substack comment thread. As I mentioned in the last podcast, I'm working on a book project, and I will be revealing that book project pretty soon because I'm going to be soliciting listeners to help me gather the material, or should I say, your experiences will be some of the material for this book. So stay tuned on that. The newsletter is also where I'll be talking about it, writing on it, growing the project. But for now, I'm just going to introduce this guest. This was a very fun podcast with a smart and clear thinker who is doing great work. As many of you know, I'm interested in psychedelics, psychedelic-assisted therapy. I think it has a huge potential to help the world, to heal trauma, and this guy is not just talking about it, he is working on it. Jesse Gould is the founder and president of the Heroic Hearts Project, a 501c3 nonprofit pioneering psychedelic therapies for military veterans. After being deployed as an Army Ranger in Afghanistan 3 times, he founded the Heroic Hearts Project in 2017 to spearhead the acceptance and use of ayahuasca therapy as a means of addressing the current mental health crisis among veterans. The Heroic Hearts Project has raised over $350,000 in scholarships from donors, including Dr. Bronner's, and partnered with the world's leading ayahuasca treatment centers. Jesse has spoken globally about psychedelics and mental health, something that's also personal to him, having battled with post-traumatic stress disorder and found relief through ayahuasca therapy. Please welcome to the podcast, Jesse Gould.
Kyle Tierman here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
Not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part of Bali.
smiles and thumbs up.
Jesse, thanks so much for joining me.
Kyle, a pleasure. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Me too. So I gotta start off by asking you about Lapland 2022.
Yeah, so I mean that actually kind of ties into the broader conversation, but I mean around a year and a half ago, I found myself in this spot where at that point I've been doing the nonprofit that I run, Broke Hearts Project, for about 4 years. Really proud of the progress we made, but I found myself mentally struggling. Like my mental health was deteriorating for a lot of reasons. You know, it's a nonprofit's like a startup, like anything else. It's a startup focused on trauma, so that's constantly in your life. And just that sort of work ethic of there's always something to do and you lose yourself to it oftentimes. And so I found myself in a spot where I was overworked. I was burnt out, like on the verge of being burnt out. Anxieties were coming back. And fortunately, I was facilitating a retreat with some veterans around that time, helping them out. And through the retreat, I had sort of the insight, the epiphany of the reason I was at that spot is because I didn't keep room for myself. I put myself last. I was putting others first, right? And, you know, it kind of made me sort of realize of like, in order for me to do my job effectively, I also have to be mentally secure and safe. You know, you have to take care of yourself first before you can take care of others. Otherwise, you're pouring out of the empty cup. And so I kind of then was like, okay, well, what is Jesse if not my work, right? And I remembered that early on, like a few years ago, I really liked doing endurance races. I really liked the challenge and the catharsis that comes out of, you know, pushing your mind and body to these limits. And I hadn't done it for a while. One, because of work just took up so much time and kind of got out of shape just because it was like morning to night. And two, COVID, obviously. At the end of the day, these are all excuses, but that, you know, it put me to that spot. So from there, it was kind of this, my marching orders were, one, start creating more space for myself. And that includes, you know, giving time to those that I love in my life. So after that, like really, you know, not doing any work on the weekends and spending that with my wife and trying to get away from that. But then also have my eye on the horizon of doing one of these races. So it just so happened a few passed and then I saw this one come up in Lapland, Finland. And so it's an ultra marathon and it's a unique design. I've done a couple of them before. And so basically over the course of 6 days, you're going to cover 155 miles and it's self-supported. So essentially you're carrying your backpack with all the whole week's food and your supplies, your sleeping bag. The service company provides tents at night, water points, and a fire at night. And that's about it. And so each day, you know, the first 4 days, you're essentially doing about a marathon a day. The fifth day, it's the long run. So you're essentially doing like 50 plus miles. And then the last day is kind of the final, like couple miles, get to the finish line kind of thing. So it's, you know, an endurance with a really long run. Mind you, with the backpack and everything like that, great community, you know, pushes you to that limit, but then you're also in these very unique remote spots. And as relates to the work, which we'll get into, what I found, you know, kind of the serendipitous nature of what often happens in this space is that Finland, as well as some other Scandinavian countries in Russia, are home to the only indigenous culture, indigenous tribe in Europe, in continental Europe, or in that space. And it's called the Sami people. And so the Sami people, they still live there, and they have a history of shamanism. They have a history of shamans being the healers of the tribe, and they would use psychoactive, you know, plants and fungi to heal their tribe. And one of the things that they would do was this mushroom called the Amanita muscaria, which is one of the most famous. Everybody's seen it. It's like the toadstool in Mario. It's in a lot of religious texts. You see them in Christmas cards, that red and white sort of mushroom stereotypical. And what a lot of people believe that a lot of the early Santa Claus mythology came from sort of this tribe, because the shaman would dry the mushrooms on trees around winter solstice. They would hand them out in sacks. They are reindeer herders, all these sort of things. And this mushroom also has psychoactive properties that make you really happy and feel like flying and all this kind of stuff. So it was just sort of the perfect synchronicity with what the work that we're already doing, which involves psychedelics and healing. And since I was going to run doing this for myself, might as well tie it into the nonprofit. So this month coming up, we're going to do education around this indigenous tribe, around these mushrooms, around why it matters to learn about indigenous cultures and preserve it. And then, you know, about the run itself. So excited, been training. My foot's actually hurting a little bit, which I have to get checked out. So fingers crossed. But for me, it's nice to get back into that, to have some sort of objective to train for, but then also betters my own mental health.
Yeah. Yeah. What's your training regimen look like?
Just put a lot of miles, run a lot.
Yes, one foot, just Forrest Gump style. I just felt like
exactly.
Running.
Just wake up, run until you can't run no more. Yeah, I tend to be a little bit less like dogmatic about training schedules and kind of more in tune with what my body's telling me. So try to put a lot of miles, combination of miles. I've been doing yoga just because I tend to have very like stiff muscles. So to get to not have injuries from that, and then just some weight training. So don't go heavy on the weight training, but still, you know, build muscles in the legs and just have overall body health and strength, because that can help with the long runs. And then I'm in Manhattan, so pretty near Central Park. So just do, you know, loops through Central Park, sometimes like smaller runs, like 5 miles, ramp it up 10 to 15. And then this weekend, you know, incorporate the backpack, which will probably weigh 20, 25 pounds. And so sort of do a long rock march. So I kind of just do it. I was, you know, I can get in the backstory, but from my military training, I just kind of do the similar sort of style just to really get the miles under you. So your body gets that spot. And like with these longer runs, it's, you're going to reach that pain point, right? Like there's always this mental spot where you just have to come to terms with your body's hurting. You don't want to wake up. You don't want to keep going. And so as long as your body's at that like baseline health level, and you know, you check, you do constant check-ins that there's no like injuries forming, then the rest of it tends to be really mental, which I've had a lot of experience with.
Yeah. I always think about the line that they say in, you know, in so many movies in the military where they say, are you hurt or are you injured? Are you hurt or are you injured? And I would imagine that being in the military, you become very literate at knowing that distinction within your own body. What is mental suffering and what is a physical injury that's coming on?
Yeah, and on a few different measures too. So in the military, I was an Army Ranger, so that involved selection and a lot of training, like Ranger School. And Ranger School is essentially like 3 months, food deprivation. I was there in the winter, so like heat deprivation, essentially. You're not sleeping. You're, you know, marching around mountains and swamps with sometimes your ruck could weigh, you know, 100 pound plus. And so it's
what's
taxing
a ruck?
Your body.
What's
like
a
big, it's like the big military backpack that you like put ropes in, ammunition in, your clothes in, your food in.
Got it.
So yeah, through that process, like you kind of, you have to get a better sense of, you know, what's an injury, what's just hurting, like how close are you to being dangerously dehydrated? How close are you to being dangerously cold? Because you oftentimes, like the training part is putting you on these thresholds to where to see if you can still effectively act and lead and react without obviously ending you up in an ambulance or ending you up with like a broken leg or where you like fall asleep and trip down a mountain, right? So it's kind of like living life on these thresholds, which is the value of the training, because then you get a better perspective of what you're capable of. And, you know, there's that sort of, I forget what the specific saying is, but it's kind of one of those similar lines of the average person or the on the average day, we really only, even when we're exerting ourselves, we're only pushing ourselves to like 60-70%, right? Like our warning lights come on pretty early on, and there's still a pretty big reserve tank that you can go off and you can push yourself through. But it's just a question of not pushing that too far. And, you know, like I said, having some sort of lasting damage.
I did a breath holding course. It was a free diving course a couple of years ago, a 3-day course. And they take you from, you know, a 2-minute breath hold to a 5-minute breath hold in the course of 3 days. And some of it is physical, some of it is technique, but a huge amount of it is mental. And to your point, just understanding that once you get that sensation to breathe, or that physical sensation of discomfort under any athletic endeavor, you're probably about halfway there. And I have taken that lesson as a real metaphor into so many different aspects of life, right? You see what humans are capable of, and it's often them just pushing past that pain point and getting comfortable in that red zone where so many other people tap out.
Yeah, absolutely. And not freaking out too, because then that heightens your stress, it heightens the tax on your body, and then it makes it even harder. It's like staying in that like calm state, you know, a lot relates to meditation, and that's also where the value is. I'm sure if you had some good breath hold, it probably stressed you out, but it felt good too. I actually just read the book Deep. It was by the same guy, James Nestor.
Yeah, yeah. I have his other book, Breath, sitting right here, and I'm just digging into it right now. It is just so fascinating what you can do if you master the breath. Have you dug into any kind of breath work yourself as a mode of, you know, altering your state of consciousness or working through these difficult situations that you've put yourself in?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of, and that's actually the veterans that we train in our program, there's a lot of similarities, because like in the military, breath is so important, because we do these stress shoots where you do some sort of physical training right before, and you're panting, you're exhausted, but then you immediately have to go to the shooting course and run along with that. And the whole point is that you have to maintain your stress levels and breath so that your bullets aren't going, you know, 100 miles off. Because if you're like panting like that, it's nearly impossible to shoot. But even in a calm state, you know, if you're shooting really far, even the slightest breath movement can really throw off the trajectory of your round. You know, they train that in like sniper school as well. And so, you know, it allows veterans to kind of understand the value, the purpose, the healing nature of breath. And especially, you know, within the psychedelic space, it's so important. Whether you're in the psychedelic journey itself, the breath is almost like the anchor. It's the thing that if the journey is becoming very intense, we really tell them to focus on their breath. So oftentimes it calms it down a little bit, but it also gives them that meditative thing to concentrate on. And so there's certain things like holotropic breath work that I've done, which was invented when LSD became illegal. By Stanley Sgroff, as a alternative, non-illegal way to get to similar psychedelic states. And that can be very powerful. A lot of people find therapy. I like the Wim Hof sort of methods. It's super easy. You know, there's some like YouTube tutorials that are like 15 minutes and kind of gets you in that that calm state. And then like the book, not to reveal something, but one of the breaths that James Nestor writes about is this, I believe it's 6 seconds inhale and then 6 seconds exhale. I think it's actually 5.5, but he says that that's one of the most effective breaths, is if you just do this slow 5.5 inhalation and then slow 5.5 exhalation. And that actually mimics a lot of like old school prayers and songs and ceremonies. And that has been shown to put people in that sort of meditative, relaxed sort of state. So when I remember, and I'm not just in the hustle and tussle of the day, I try to do that, of just remember my breath through it. And I think even that, just that simple remembering your breath, slowing down, is one of the best things you can do, you know, because adding on more and more practices can get a little bit tricky depending on your lifestyle.
When you were in the Army Rangers, did you learn any specific breath techniques, or did that come more intuitively?
I think they teach it more now. Like, the Army is really getting more into some of this stuff, like meditation and even some, you know, yoga stuff, even acupuncture. There was some breath stuff, but I don't quite remember it. But it really wasn't like ingrained in you. So you kind of had to figure it out yourself. I think like sniper school does, certain schools do a little bit more. And then it's kind of more of like a generic calming breath. Like, if you're stressed out, just take deeper breaths until your pulse kind of calms down. But I think they're a little bit more rigorous about it now because they see the value and the performance factor of it, especially in special ops.
Yeah, it's a very cheap way to alter your state of consciousness almost immediately.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I think, it hasn't been caught on, but I know some people that have been trying to do studies with military with holotropic breath work in terms of trauma relief.
Right. Yeah, I know there's a lot of programs that do that. So just last question on the run, as you're running, have you developed any kind of breathing techniques as you're training for this upcoming ultramarathon?
I haven't really. So if you have good techniques, I'm more than happy to hear it. For me, it's just kind of making sure I'm breathing, just kind of keeping myself in that calm state. That, again, that was one of the things, you know, there wasn't a direct technique, but one of the things we had to learn in training and selection would be, you know, we'd be on these long runs, you know, 5+ miles, 10 miles, and they'd make you do sprints and like buddy carries and all sorts of other stuff that just got you exhausted, and you would never stop. You had to regain your breath in a pretty fast jog. So you know, sink or swim kind of thing. You had to learn while running how to keep in that consistent sort of breath state, so you're not overdoing it. You're not getting there. So in this coming month, I'm definitely going to look more into that, get back into that mind frame.
There's a story in Breath by James Nestor where he talks about a running coach who would force his athletes to take a sip of water and run the track with the water in their mouth and then spit the water out when they cross the finish line to train them into nose breathing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember that one. Yeah, that was good. And then he was doing some of the ones where he's like holding his breath during runs and wanting to puke afterwards.
Yeah, it's like the joke. Why is air a lot like sex? Because it's no big deal till you're not getting any. So as I want to ask now about Heroic Hearts. For people who don't know, can you just give the elevator pitch of how this came to be and what it is that you're doing now?
Yeah, absolutely. So Heroic Hearts Project is it's a nonprofit in the US, and we actually have branches in the UK and Canada. And its direct purpose is to connect military veterans to psychedelic-based treatment options for trauma from war and build communities of support for the veterans to help continue the healing that they get. And so the quick story, like I said, I was in the military, a number of deployments to Afghanistan. When I got out, I hit some mental health struggles myself. I didn't expect it, but there they were, and just really not doing well. I was doing well on the outside, but on the inside, I was complete turmoil. Went through the VA, the Department of Veteran Affairs, and there just wasn't many options. It was more of a maintenance sort of program of like, you're going to have to deal with this and here's some medication versus this is what's wrong. Let's figure out a way to overcome it. Around that time, I heard about a psychedelic called ayahuasca that comes from the Amazonian region of Peru, or the Amazonian region in general. So Brazil, Peru, Colombia, Ecuador, each have their own tribes and traditions. And, you know, at first I was skeptical. I had never done a psychedelic, never factored in that a psychedelic would be anything I would ever want to do. But there I was in the spot of necessity, and I just knew I needed to do something. And whatever was offered to me in the US really wasn't working. So I kind of took a leap of faith at that time and checked it out, went to Peru, after doing some research and found a retreat center and went through these traditional ceremonies over the course of a week. And it was extremely challenging, and happy to go into whatever dynamic of it. But towards the end, or at the end, I just felt like a new person. So not only did I process some things psychologically, but also just felt like my brain reset was more efficient. I've said it felt like it defragged, like you would a computer, where afterwards it just felt like a better functioning unit. And these changes continued on. The anxieties that I felt beforehand just no longer steamrolled me. The desire to just suppress life with alcohol was no longer there. All sorts of different factors. And so after that, you know, coming from the military, for those that are unfamiliar, there's been, at least for the past 20 years, a mental health crisis and a suicide epidemic in the military community. And despite hundreds of billions of dollars, the government has not been able to figure out how to overcome this or address this. And so myself, it's not rare that people like myself have double-digit friends that have taken their own life as a result of trauma. And so it was just at this time of, hey, I stumbled on to this thing that's these ceremonies that have been going on for thousands of years that I had no idea about. So let me at least bring this to other people. If they're in the same boat, then why not, you know, give them extra tools if they're inclined to. And so that was the start of Heroic Hearts Project. And we've been operational for more than 5 years. We've served hundreds of veterans. And essentially, we create this program where, one, we educate it and present it to a veteran in a way more approachable that they'd understand. And then we do this whole multi-month program where it has a whole preparation phase and getting them in the mind frame with support, coaching, providing financial grants, the actual ceremonies where we work with centers that we've vetted and that are sustainable and respectful to the cultures these come from. And then the aftercare, which is called integration in the psychedelic space, where the vast majority come away from these retreats with pretty big experiences. A lot of profound things come about, a lot of new insights into their lives or their bad patterns, a lot of motivation to change their life. And all that's great. And there are some lasting benefits that we've seen. But the integration phase is, how are you going to incorporate this into your life, into your day to day? What habits, good habits, are you going to do to keep that going?
Got it. Couldn't you dive in a little bit more to what you said you were not doing well when you got back from the military? What did that look like?
Yeah. So I got out and I thought before I joined the military, I already had a degree in economics. I'd worked in finance. And so when I got out, I thought I was going to hit the ground running. I was excited. There wasn't anything that I thought was particularly harmful to my psyche from my deployments. And so I got out, went into finance. And I think just sort of the change of dynamic and some of these unresolved issues, it just led to just like a lot of anxiety, to where I just have panic attacks some days or just not want to get out of bed, some depression, just certain days I wasn't motivated, couldn't see people. That was just like a dread that would come over me and, you know, suppress it all with alcohol. So just drinking to a spot where, you know, at the end of the week, just like drink to get drunk and, you know, not really caring about myself, putting myself into risky situations that could have ended up in all sorts of different ways. And so just, you know, I was fortunate that I never crossed any line and there wasn't permanent damage. But it was all, there's a lot of red flags there that I was fortunate enough to see that I just wasn't happy. I just got to the end of the week and I just was more unhappy during that week than I was happy.
Hmm. One thing that I was curious about is the influence that isolation has in post-traumatic stress disorder. I recently read a book called Tribe by Sebastian Younger, and he talks about how Israel has incredibly low rates of PTSD. And he posits that the reason for that is because there's no schism between military life and civilian life. So they don't face the same alienation that US soldiers face. The US has extremely high rates of PTSD. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts about this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think it's a big factor. And that's kind of been part of the learning journey that I've had and my team has had since we started this, because when I started it, and if you look at it, PTSD itself has just become a really big umbrella term for any veteran with a issue, with a mental health issue. And some physicians or some therapists might argue with this, but this is what we see, is that they just kind of rubber stamp, hey, you have PTSD. So what we've come to, and when I was struggling through this, I was like, there has to be more than that. Like this seems to be a more complex issue. And this is also the reason why we think psychedelics work so well, is because they hit the brain in such a very complex way. It's not just like a normal medication where it just affects one receptor, shuts on or turns on or shuts off something. And so the factor you found is, yeah, definitely there is that psychological issue of like trauma and being in those certain states that stick with you and cause bad, you know, patterns and thoughts. There's a physical issue. Like myself, I worked a lot with mortar tubes, like explosive, pretty much rockets. And they show that concussive force can cause damage and throw off hormone levels. But then the other factors that are really not talked about is isolation, the lack of community, and the lack of sense of purpose. So when veterans get out of the military, one, for the purpose, they're doing this thing that has geopolitical ramifications, and they're at the front lines of news, and they feel like what they're doing is of importance. Like the, you know, there's a lot that do tie into the, like, defending this or that, or bringing this to helping people, you know, like of service. And the isolation is they get out and they go to their communities, but oftentimes they, in the military, they become so close that oftentimes the people they serve with can be closer than the family. But then, you know, with work and travel, they might lose contact. It's very hard in geography. And then they have to go to school or work, and then they're almost speaking a different language, because it can be hard for people coming from different walks of life to fully understand. They lose that ability. So part of it is training of how to become a civilian again, but also the community side is really lacking. Like our generation of veterans, especially, we really don't go to the VFW or the American Legion, which were really popular after the Vietnam War, and provide that sort of structure. You know, this generation is far less religious, don't really go to church. So there's really not a great community center that for veterans that rely on positive mental health, kind of similar to what, like the studio you say you're developing, like something like that for veterans would be amazing. I think would go a long way in solving a lot of the problems of that. There's actually another, I was just watching a TED talk recommended, and a guy named Captain Plummer. He was a fighter pilot, Top Gun fighter pilot, shot down in Vietnam, and was a prisoner of war from the Vietnam for 6 years. And I think he was in the same camp as John McCain or POW at the same time. And he was saying the statistic of the vets that came home, the Vietnam vets that came home, had PTSD rates of 30 or 40%, whereas the POWs had PTSD ratings of 4%. And he goes on to talk about sort of the other factor of, like, instead of going straight from war back to, you know, the day-to-day life and the sort of culture shock, they had to make themselves mentally tough. They had to protect the brain in between their 2 ears, and the lessons that they were forced to learn. Not saying being a POW is good for mental health, but there's lessons to learn from that of why is there this big difference, right? So there's so many different things that are not medication-based that we need to look at to resolve this issue. But that's in the medical model, not necessarily how we go about it.
Why do you think that ayahuasca is so effective for these soldiers who you know, many of whom who have been through the VA and had unsuccessful results with other methods?
Yeah, so ayahuasca, and we're seeing this with a lot of different psychedelics or psychoactive. So, for instance, MDMA. Which is the chemical component of ecstasy, that's having like 67% success rate in treatment resistant depression, PTSD, and that's about to pass FDA clinical trial. So great breakthrough. Works a little bit different, but we're seeing all these emergence of these substances that we previously categorized as illegal narcotics. The psychedelics, the hallucinogenics, like mushrooms, like ayahuasca, and this is all a supposition, you know, the research still is not there, but this is really what we've seen on the grass level, on the ground level, as well as backed up by some early research. So one, within the hallucinogenic state, the person goes there with preparation, proper set and setting, and they feel safe and secure, and they're kind of able to go deep into it. The hallucination, the properties itself really allow trauma to come to the surface. So especially veterans become very good at compartmentalizing. And when you keep pushing these traumas down, it tends to have really bad outcomes physically and emotionally, where you have outbursts or anger or physical issues as well. And with the psychedelic, because one, it suppresses default mode network of how you normally go, can suppress the ego. So these traumas come up, these subconscious processings, and in the psychedelic, because they're coming up, it almost puts you in these worlds or interpretations of these traumas to where you have to address it. You have to release it. You have to come to terms with it. And within that, then that allows reframing. And that can happen very uniquely per person. So for instance, we've had individuals that had childhood trauma, some sort of childhood abuse, and they go into this experience and they go back to one of the points of trauma, but that allows them to see it from a different level. It's not as traumatic as it first was. They're most protected in there. But then they're also able to reframe it to where, instead of being this victim, possibly look how strong they were to survive that, or to view it in different ways, and then have it stored in a different way in their brain. Other people, when they suppress these traumas, it can put them in the spot. So a very common thing with veterans is they go into this really challenging, almost like hell-like state until they sort of let go of that. And then they come to realize that the reason why it was so tough and physically hard in the ayahuasca is because that's what they've been doing to themselves on a day-to-day basis, from the self-hate and this guilt that they've been storing, even if they didn't know it. You know, a lot of them wouldn't necessarily come up and say, "Oh, I have a lot of self-hate," but it's not until they see it and realize it, and be that in itself, one, gives them that ability to sort of move on, but then also understand that that's a problem and make changes in their life to where they're not doing that, and find some self-love. And so psychedelics really empower people and almost flip certain receptors to make self-love much more attainable, achievable. On the other side, again, speculation, there's some evidence that it can help heal the brain on a physical level, increase plasticity, so new neural pathways. And on the final side of the community, like, it does bring people in this spot where they feel connected, especially to those around them. That's why we do these veteran group retreats, and they become so close. Like, we have signal chats of veterans from years ago that still communicate, talk, still interact with us, because it was bringing them back to that brotherhood, that sisterhood that they missed. And it really focused on how important that is to them. So again, they can make changes to find that in their day-to-day life. So there are a few different stages, and that's what I was saying before. It's such a complex, these are complex molecules that interact with our brain, but there's a lot of evidence that we co-evolve with that. And so for a lot of people, it makes sense of like, hey, this is an important part in our culture and our, and possibly our health.
So one thing that I see you doing with Heroic Hearts that is super valuable is providing a kind of on-ramp for veterans to be able to have these conversations or even be open to something like psychedelics. You can speak their language and provide a bridge in a way that a Burning Man hippie who makes the pitch to them might not be able to. And I was wondering if you could speak to that, and as well as talk about how you have those conversations with veterans who may not initially be open to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, that's sort of what we wanted to bring, sort of a comfort level and a trust level. So veterans, you know, like it, even with therapists, it can be very hard for them to bridge that trust gap because of different walks of life, similar to what we talked about before. So having another veteran there, especially those that they know or respect. So we've had some high level veterans go through our program with big followings. And these are, you know, like multiple deployment guys that, like you said, they're not like the Burning Man type. And so when they actually have changes that you can see, you know, when they like smile or are just more goofy and they're not that former rigorous, you know, traumatized self, people are like, hey man, what happened? You know, like what, and that's the biggest evidence we have, is just that sort of word of mouth where people see it. You know, it's not our job to convince people to do psychedelics, nor do I ever want to push somebody there. But if they have even the slightest interest, I want to provide them the actual information and all the things, those mechanisms I was saying before. We actually have scientific evidence that starts to support that, so they can kind of see why this works. And so having that sort of veteran connection really helps them feel like they're not just going to join a cult, or they're not going to just like, you know, they don't want to become this long haired hippie, even though they might become that afterwards. But that's not like the end state of this. You know, the way we frame it is like, these are just other tools. And like, similar to any tool, it's not just about taking a psychedelic. It's about preparing for it. And it's about utilizing what you get from the experience in your life. If you don't do all steps of that, then it's only going to be of limited effect, or it could be kind of throw you in sort of a weird state if you don't prepare for it. And you get into sort of like bad, like experience sort of realm. But yeah, and that veteran voice, we've seen that in policy that we do as well, because, you know, veterans are fortunately respected in this country. And there's a lot of guilt, I think, on the political level, if not, there should be, for sort of the kind of leaving us behind in a lot of ways, especially on the mental health side. And so when we talk to these politicians and we tell them in a very straightforward way, where it's like Rangers and Navy SEALs of like, hey, we signed up for this, we'd happily go back over in certain cases, and we're telling you that this works, and this is the only thing that's worked. So it's not just, and these are guys and girls that aren't just coming to us out of a whim of like, let me try a psychedelic. These are people that have been in therapy for 10, 15 years, who have been on, you know, the whole handful. It's not uncommon for somebody to be on 15 different medications. We've served a couple of Vietnam vets who have been suffering for, you know, 40 years plus, and just kind of had to deal with the fact that they had PTSD. And after these experiences, finally found some form of relief, some sort of happiness, some sort of self-forgiveness and love. And so what we're finding with the veteran voice is, you know, not only is it helping other veterans get this when nothing else has worked, but that's kind of leading the way for other people to gain access. And everybody's kind of caught on to that, which is why there's so much research focus on veterans, or so much policy focus on veterans, because it can really make this a bipartisan issue. And they can be very good spokespeople for this and understanding a little bit more why it works.
Yeah, very well said. What would you say to someone who might be listening to this podcast who is more liberal, maybe wants to support veterans, like, you know, likes the idea of that? I don't think that really it's a controversial issue that veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder is bad, but they don't necessarily want to support what they see as senseless wars. And the, you know, the acts that a lot of these veterans are then doing overseas. How would you help someone kind of square that issue in their mind?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there's a few factors. If you're just completely analytical, my argument is that veterans are the best ways to increase everybody's access to effective mental health modalities. So if you're especially a believer that psychedelics can heal, veterans are helping this fast track to a way that it's starting to become more accessible and people are paying attention versus any other group that we've seen. And I'm not putting any sort of like, that's better or worse, I'm saying that's actually what's happening, you know? And so if you just want the ends justify the means, you know, if you can rest on that, that's fine. If you're those that want to understand, and I can understand that the disparity between those two sort of thoughts, the soldiers there, the vast majority sign up sheerly out of this sort of kind of service archetype, this warrior archetype, which has always been needed in society. There's always been a need of somebody to, you know, sacrifice themselves for the safety of others. That's the common thing among human history. So there's always been that. And there's always been people who have been driven and drawn to that. And the vast majority of people that I was surrounded by fell into that mold where they were open to putting themselves in risk for the sake of their family, for the sake of their community, and would gladly do it again. Just that's how they're driven. The same way where some people are just driven to be healers in the medical or educators. It's their sort of calling, their scheme in life. We should not equate the wars that the veterans, the soldiers, generally speaking, they're not those that are necessarily dividing or voting on us. The wars that we get into are decided by the politicians, maybe on the generals and all that kind of stuff. But that becomes a political role at a certain point. And so if you have anger about the wars, that anger should be turned towards the politicians in my mind and not necessarily the soldiers. There are bad seeds. There are things that we always need to address, and it's the nature of this. And we always need to figure out a way to stop that, prevent that. But if you actually look at the vast majority of people over there and serving as a baseline noble and just trying to do their best and put in crazy situations that are hard to fathom, then we have to also allow them to heal. And I think everybody deserves the right to heal, but especially these people that are doing that out of in my mind, sort of a purity sort of level. And so that's kind of what I tell people. And that's what I believe. I mean, that's why I served. I didn't have to. I was going down a Wall Street path, and I wanted to give back to this country. I wanted to do something greater than me, because I felt very fortunate in life. And so that's why I joined. And I was met by a lot of people that were in sort of the same mind frame. In terms of the wars too, you know, like there's a lot of veterans that are feel just as disturbed by what happened in Afghanistan and how long they went and how every president just sort of kicked the can down the road in terms of getting out. And so that's not an uncommon thing. But to those people, who do they think are going to be the biggest advocates of changing it? The people who have never experienced war, or the people who come out of it, feel disgruntled, are able to heal, and then lead to changes in policy so those sort of things don't happen? So if you actually want these systems, these ecosystems to improve, you have to improve the different component parts, including the people that have these bad experiences, because they are always the best advocates for why it needs to change. Similar to myself and many other veterans who were disserved by the mental health system and are now becoming very powerful advocates that we need to change this. And because we have come from that background, that's why our story is believable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think that it's you're involved in a modality that has asymmetrical returns. There really aren't many things we've seen in the mental health system like psychedelics. I do think that it's forcing a lot of people to turn their heads, and it's a very intelligent move to put veterans first, because it is, you know, it's one of the ways that you can get both sides of the aisle on board. And I really commend the work that you're doing generally. Just wrapping up here, where would you like to see Heroic Hearts in, let's say, 3 years from now? You guys have been around for five. It seems like you're growing really quickly. What where would you like to go, and what support do you need to get there?
Yeah, absolutely. And just quick point on the last statement. A bill was just supported. Similar bills were just supported around psychedelics by both Dan Crenshaw and AOC. We just had a bill by Cory Booker and Rand Paul. So it's just showing you the proof there of like these people from very different beliefs all getting behind this, and with sort of the veteran catchphrase there as well. So that's showing you the power, and that would have taken, I think, so many more years had it not been for that. Our eyes, you know, we've been at sort of the front edge, the point of the spear of this veteran suicide crisis for, you know, we're the longest running veteran program in this. And it allows, it's challenging, but it allows us to see sort of the shifting tides and how things are going. And so we're fortunate now that we even don't really have to advocate for psychedelics anymore as much. Let me rephrase that. We don't have to advocate for them as much because there's so much evidence now. There's so much publicity. You know, Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, now has Netflix. It's in popular culture. It's being studied by Johns Hopkins, Stanford, Harvard. So it's here and it's not going anywhere because the results are so well above and beyond. And so now we have to shift our eyes to like, okay, well, what does this look like? Are we ready? And how does this actually transform the mental health state to where it doesn't just look like the same sort of thing? And that's our biggest concern, is we don't want a situation where the people who are currently disenfranchised by mental health continue to be so. You know, minority communities, veterans that fall through the cracks of the VA, other communities. And the fortunate thing with psychedelics is they are open source. The mushroom grows fairly easy outside. Ayahuasca is a plant. But within that, if it goes through the medical model like clinics, it's going to be very expensive. Like the MAPS MDMA trials, if you look at it, it's been like $30,000 per veteran, if I'm not mistaken. If you have a physician standing with you for psilocybin, it's like a 5-hour experience. All of this is going to be very expensive. So our eyes are shifting to, how do we make this more sustainable? How do we make this more accessible? And how do we make this sort of independent, to where it's not just controlled by one entity or body? And that really is that community, that topic that keeps coming up in this conversation. And so what we are actively doing right now is we still are helping veterans get to these retreats, but what does psychedelics look like in the US when these laws do pass, as they will inevitably already pass in Oregon and a lot of traction in other states? So our mind is, how do we make these community-based infrastructure systems that, you know, we can help build a blueprint and support, but then it's on the community itself to implement it, grow it, spread it. But there'll still be safety checks. There'll still be trained facilitators and support. And then within that, there'll be an ecosystem, because then people locally can go to this. They know the people there. It might be other veterans. It might be other groups. They can possibly get some money by being coaches or peer support to others. And so that's what we're designing right now, is in the future, we want this where it's not going to break the bank and people don't have to choose between paying rent or their mental health. But they're also surrounded by people that they know, and they can meet up with those people with psychedelics without it. And it's, like I said, going to these spots where maybe they have access to psychedelics, but then float tanks or breathwork courses or cooking courses or hikes. And that's what we need to create. We need to rebuild these community-based systems, because I think we've all seen from the COVID era, like, I think it really just highlighted how isolated a lot of us are and how hard it is to find that localized community. So that's where we're at. And I think psychedelics will be that sort of tinder, that spark to really help us enact this change, because it is a big push. But I think the time is right now.
Is there a place where people can support your work?
Absolutely. So the website is heroicheartsproject.org. We are on all social media, but the main one we use is Instagram at heroicheartsproject. On our website, we're a 501c3 nonprofit, so all money coming in is tax deductible. And it really is, your support goes directly to helping these veterans. We keep the overhead costs as low as possible, and we rely completely on people's generosity to help that go over there. Each vet is about $4,500 to get there with travel, coaching, all that kind of stuff. And so the more people are able to support, the more veterans we are able to support. Our wait list is, you know, near 1,000 at this point. So we need a lot of help. And the Lapland race I'm doing, we're going to be posting about it, doing some education pieces on social media, on our Instagram. And that's also a fundraiser. So, please tune in. I'll be actually doing some updates from the race while I'm doing that. So, any way you can support, even if you can just give some time on our website is the best way to go about it. And if you're a veteran interested, we have an application on the website as well. So heroicheartsproject.org.
Jesse, thank you so much. Best of luck on your upcoming ultra marathon, and be sure to keep breathing, man.
You too, Kyle. It's been an absolute pleasure, and look forward to visiting you in LA and the next conversation we have.
Thanks, Jesse.
That's our show. Before you head off into your day, click the link below and sign up for my Substack newsletter. Every Friday, I send one newsletter with a new word that I learned or think is cool and write a little something about that word. So if you love growing your vocabulary, if you're the kind of weirdo who thinks that reading is sexy, click the link below or go to tierman.substack.com. That's tierman.substack.com to sign up for the weekly newsletter. Thank you to everyone who donates to this podcast via Substack. I rely on listeners like you to keep this thing going. So if you have some extra change, if this is the kind of thing that you want to support, I very much appreciate those paid subscriptions. And if you don't have the cash, just sign up for it for free. No big deal. Go be a good person. Get out into the water, whatever body of water is closest to you. Lake, river, bathtub, or ocean. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.